Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune into Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I'm Bob Enyart. Welcome to the third program of our series, June is Grand Canyon Month at Real Science Radio. Fred Williams is back from assignment in Hawaii, but he's given us the rest of the month to complete this series, so I'm looking forward to having Fred back in studio. So far, we've aired and provided written lists online at rsr.org/Grand Canyon. Our list of problems with the river carved the canyon, and regarding the depositing of the canyon's layers, one on top of another, and this allegedly occurring over vast ages, we've presented our list of problems with the canyon's millions of years. Today, we look at problems with the flood carved the canyon. So for our third Grand Canyon program, we welcome back Brian Nickel. Hey, Brian.
Hello, Bob. Thanks for having me. It's good to be back to discuss this important topic.
Brian, an airline pilot, has been listening to this series. He's been talking to his co-pilots because they fly over the Grand Canyon in that region a couple times a week. His first name is Darren, and he told me that the evidence in our first two shows was so powerful. He watched your video on the Grand Canyon, and now he's watched your entire series on the hydroplate theory and the global flood. And so he's explaining to his coworkers how the canyon region that they're so familiar with was actually formed, and not by that relatively tiny thread of a river, and not by a little water over a long time, but by a lot of water over a little time.
That's great to hear. That's what those videos are for. And I'm glad to hear that people are listening to them and seeing the evidence that's in there.
Yeah, it's just so exciting. And Brian, thank you for giving Real Science Radio permission to publish your video on Blu-ray and on DVD. We will be offering it as a set with a video from Mission Imperative, Mike Snavely. He's got a fabulous video, The Puzzle on the Plateau. And I'd say that's more introductory. And so what a 1-2 punch, his introduction to the Grand Canyon, and then your more detailed explanation of how it formed. We're just so excited about that. If people would like to get the set together, the two videos, they can call us 1-800-8-NYART, 1-800-836-9278. But Brian, some creationist, they claim that the floodwaters carved the canyon.
Right, and that's like an opposite claim to those who say that the river carved the canyon, which we discussed and pretty well disproved in our first program.
Yeah, so let me give an example to the audience of a statement of this hypothesis, and it's from the amazing ministry at creation.com out of Australia, CMI, Creation Ministries International. Their article by geologist Michael Ord, How Old is the Grand Canyon? It indicates that the flood carved the canyon. So let me quote from him verbatim. And I've met Michael on a few occasions. I value our friendship, but I strongly disagree with him on this. His article ends saying that, quote, the late flood channelized flow carved the canyon. Let me say that again. The late flood channelized flow carved the canyon. So, Brian, that's what we're going to now provide evidence against, that the flood carved the canyon. But can you first explain what Ord and CMI mean by the phrase, the late flood channelized flow?
Yeah, they are talking about the toward the end of the flood, when floodwaters are receding off of the continents, and they believe that those formed into channelized flow patterns, in contrast with flow patterns like sheet erosion. Hmm. And that's what they're, I believe, describing there.
I had the honor this past November of spending time at the Grand Canyon with Dr. Walt Brown, And I asked him about, and I think you recall this, Brian, the week he scheduled back in 2006 to go to the canyon with Mike Ord and a half dozen geologists, all of whom were invited to join them by Brent Carter. Brent Carter, I've spoken with Brent. He's the chief geologist, or he was for about 40 years, for the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation for the Pacific Northwest over about five states. The field trip would give Mike and Walt each 3 days to show the evidence for their respective explanations for the Grand Canyon. Mike Ord's that the draining waters of the flood carved the canyon, and Walt Brown's that two great lakes, the ancient Hopi Lake and Grand Lake, had a natural dam breach, one undercutting the other, with their catastrophic draining carving the canyon. Now, the Great Hopi Lake, prehistoric, according to some, was recently described as an ancient lake by the state geologist of Arizona. And the larger lake, which is estimated that it held twice as much water as today's Lake Michigan, the larger lake was the one that Walt Brown discovered and named Grand Lake. Well, after Walt took the group on a 3-day tour to show his evidence, then Mike had 3 days to show his evidence. But as I've heard from Walt and confirmed from Brent Carter, Mike Ord surprised the group. He surprised everyone and announced that the 6-day field trip would be adjourned, would be ended 3 days early, and that he wasn't prepared to spend that time that was allotted to show evidence for his flood runoff model. And so that was it. Everybody went home early. So now, Brian, that brings us to today, 2018, and our list of problems with the flood carved the canyon.
Right. Did the runoff of the global flood, the floodwaters themselves, carve the canyon?
Hmm.
Well, for starters, what those waters had done was to deposit the sedimentary layers that make up the canyon and that we see in the canyon.
Right.
And later on, they would be carved by those lakes that you discussed.
All right. So the floodwaters did do that, but did they carve the canyon? And I know that you agree with Walt Brown. They did not. You have about a half dozen reasons to share with the audience why the floodwaters, the flood runoff, did not carve the canyon.
That's right. First, the canyon is unique. There's only one Grand Canyon. Nowhere else in the world do we see a canyon in the position that it is, a canyon of the size of Grand Canyon and the enormity that we see. It is unparalleled anywhere else in the world.
Yeah, one of the seven wonders of the world. We don't see Grand Canyons elsewhere in North America. There are none in Canada, none on the East Coast, Midwest, Mexico, just in Arizona. And this argument is just like our argument against the river carved the canyon, that there are rivers all over the world and only one Grand Canyon. So that's an argument against this hypothesis, because since floodwaters were running off the continents all over the world, why wouldn't there be 70 Grand Canyons, dozens of Grand Canyons spread around the continents? If the canyon was cut by the late flood runoff, then there could be Grand Canyons all over in Europe, Asia, Africa, South America, Australia even, but they're not there. So that's a pretty
strong
first argument that the floodwaters were not sufficient to carve a Grand Canyon.
Something very, very unique happened up on that Colorado Plateau.
All right. So that's argument number one.
That's right. And so the second argument is that there is time-sensitive evidence on the plateau that indicates that the canyon was carved a few hundred years probably after the flood.
Time-sensitive evidence. So you're saying we could see things in the region at the canyon that show that centuries passed after the flood before it was carved. How so?
Well, if the canyon were cut by flood runoff, then it is likely that instead of having so many steep cliffs like we see in the walls of the Grand Canyon. Instead, those walls would have slumped if it was still soft sediments directly after the flood.
Wow.
And so there needs to have been time for those to at least partially solidify, partially harden.
Wow. So we have cliffs. We have the walls of the Grand Canyon. The canyon is, what, on average, like 5,000 a mile deep, some places 6,000 feet deep. There are many places where the cliff faces are incredibly steep. And so if all that had just been water-laden sediments, boy, you could just picture that it's all going to slump in. It's like wet sand at the beach.
Yeah, we would refer to it as the Grand Dish, but not the Grand Canyon, not a deep, steep canyon the way the Grand Canyon was carved.
The Grand Bowl or something like that.
Yeah. Another one of those time-sensitive evidences is the Kaibab limestone layer, which appeared to have been rather hard by the time water was flowing over it and eroding sediments off of its face. And so the Kaibab limestone layer is really a testament to the fact that it had to have been hardened limestone by the time that the canyon was getting carved.
Now, when people are standing on the rim of the canyon, so you're standing a mile above the floor of the canyon, what are you standing on up there?
That is the Kaibab limestone layer. So whether you visit the north rim or the south rim, what you are standing on when you're looking over the edge is the top of the Kaibab limestone layer. And that layer seems to have been able to resist flow in some channels and in some very large spillways that show that it had to have been hard ahead of time before the carving of those spillways. So that is really good evidence that the floodwaters were not what carved into the limestone, but the limestone had to have been hard ahead of time, and that it was hundreds of years later that breaching lake waters carved through those Mesozoic sediments that were above the Kaibab limestone.
Well, yeah, let's talk about that for a second. It's called the Great Denudation. We discussed that earlier in the series. A couple thousand cubic miles of sediments removed, and it was sheet erosion off of the top of the Kaibab. So when all that rock was catastrophically removed above the Grand Canyon, before you even start carving out the Grand Canyon, that sheet erosion of those Mesozoic layers, that was removed, and it was the Kaibab that stopped that erosion because it was already hard.
That's exactly right. There needed to be time for the Kaibab limestone layer to harden and for the limestone in the water to precipitate out, and that required time for the waters to cool to a point where precipitation would occur and cling to the sediment grains forming the Kaibab limestone layer. And there is a feature north of the canyon above Marble Canyon, and it's funnel shaped, and in hydroplate theory it's referred to as the funnel. And that funnel is not dish shaped, it is flat bottomed. And the reason it's flat bottomed is because as the Mesozoic sediments were being washed away when Grand Lake breached, it reached the Kaibab limestone and it was hard enough to resist the flow. And so it widened the channel, but it didn't deepen it. And so that's why that channel is flat bottomed. And that is very good evidence that the Kaibab limestone layer was hard at the time of the lake breach. And that requires time. It couldn't have happened directly after the flood.
So, Brian, that funnel, it's 18 miles long. It's 12 miles wide. And it's such a dramatic feature. It really beautifully marks where Grand Lake breached. And so that then is a part of the second argument, the time-sensitive evidence that the Kaibab had to harden so that these features would end up the way we see them today.
That's right. And in my video, at one point in discussing this funnel, I posed the question, if a breaching lake didn't carve this feature, then what did? And I'd open that up to anybody to discuss. But the third item that showed that the flood didn't carve the canyon directly after the flood is that the canyon was carved at high altitude through the middle of high plateaus. And so that, again, really speaks to the uniqueness here. And something is very strange that happened up on the Colorado Plateau.
Yeah, because when there are flood waters running off, the energy that they pick up as they're running downhill, that's where you think they're going to do their most erosive damage. So you are a mile above sea level, and to carve this canyon out that high up, that's and to not carve Grand Canyons lower at sea level, that's quite an argument.
So in Wayne Rainey's book, Carving the Grand Canyon, he wrote that, quote, oddly enough, the Grand Canyon is located in a place where it seemingly shouldn't be.
Yeah.
And I agree with him.
Yeah, he's the expert that you quoted, I think, in our first program. He writes that on page 20 of his book, when you look at the elevation of the terrain where the Grand Canyon is, how high it is above sea level, and when you realize the energy required for water to carve out such a canyon, and then also it's in this desert terrain, partly because of its elevation. It's so dry there. And so you not only have to carve out the canyon, but you need the water to carve out all the side canyons. So yeah, the canyon is at this high altitude, exactly where you would never imagine a canyon would form, either by a river or by the floodwater runoff.
That's right. I mean, you need energy to carve that canyon, and being that it's up already high on a continent, you need to find evidence somewhere around there that shows that there was a source of energy to carve all that material. And to carve it in such a way that it left such evidence as, why, if it carved it, did it not carve through the Kaibab limestone? It had to have hardened first. So some of the uniqueness of this is that the Grand Canyon sits, as you've said, high on the Colorado Plateau, and the average altitude of the Colorado Plateau is 6,200 feet above sea level.
Wow.
It cuts through both the Colorado and the Kaibab Plateau, the Grand Canyon, that is.
All right.
And the Kaibab Plateau is an upwarp on top of the Colorado Plateau. And that Kaibab upwarp, or Kaibab Plateau, it rises 2,000 feet above the top of the Colorado Plateau.
Wow.
So the altitude and the position of this huge canyon at such a high elevation makes the area very dry, like a desert region. Anybody who visits there, it's a high desert region. And so that's a real mystery. And there's a reason that Mike Snavely named his video The Puzzle on the Plateau.
The Puzzle on the Plateau. So some folks have said that, well, the Grand Canyon really isn't that surprising, because there are massive canyons around the world and they're submarine canyons. They're submerged. So they say the Grand Canyon isn't really unique, because on the continental shelves, we do find massive canyons beneath the ocean waters. That's true, right?
Yeah, that is true. And those are pretty readily explained by the runoff directly after the flood. The potential energy of the water that is flowing down off of the continents by the time it reaches the continental shelves. And as hydroplate theory shows uniquely, that ocean water levels were much, much lower than they are today, so that those continental shelves were exposed and so that erosion could occur. So that is readily explained. And there's a reason why we see so many large canyons in the continental shelves due to that runoff.
So I know we don't want to get into this. You describe it so beautifully in your series on the hydroplate theory, but the continental shelves and the continental slopes and the pattern that they make around the edges of the continents all over the world, Brian, you've done a masterful job of explaining all that. But as the waters, the floodwaters are running off the continents, now you have a significant elevation difference. So that elevation gives you the potential energy you need. The water is coming off the continents, and it is eroding what today are submarine canyons. Totally true.
That's exactly right. But at the time that they were being eroded, they were not submarine. They were actually exposed. And that is why those channelized waters and those waters that were running off of the continents were able to erode mm-hmm. into those exposed shelves. But claiming that the Grand Canyon is no big deal because of submarine canyons that we see out on the perimeters at the edge of the continents, that's like finding a huge ocean cruise ship lying in the middle of the desert on top of the Colorado Plateau and not being surprised, because after all, there are plenty of ocean liners at sea level near all the continents today.
Right.
Well,
right.
That's true, but you would still be very surprised to find an ocean liner with no water around. Why is it up there? And so I wonder how in the world this ship got there and why. And that's the same question that I have for the Grand Canyon. Why is this odd, very large feature carved high up in the middle of a continent on a high plateau?
So I think the only way to accomplish that is you need tremendous potential energy with a volume of water that has been raised up above the Grand Canyon.
That's exactly what I would go looking for. As we discussed previously, of course, it wasn't the Colorado River. It just doesn't have the kind of energy needed to carve such a large, large feature.
Mm-hmm.
And I highlight that over and over again in the Grand Canyon video online. But Walt Brown is also a mechanical engineer, and he too is not satisfied with the poor explanations of just simple flood runoff, explaining all those features, all those strange features of the Grand Canyon and really the surrounding area.
Mm-hmm.
So he knew of the existence of the ancient Hopi Lake bed to the southeast of the Grand Canyon. But Hopi Lake didn't have the volume of water nor the energy to fully explain the size and all the features in the Grand and around the Grand Canyon. So in 1986 to 87, Walt had done a great deal of research and visitation around that area in Utah and Colorado, and he discovered Grand Lake.
Mm.
And Walt discovered that this much larger lake bed exists to the northeast of the Grand Canyon, which he named Grand Lake.
Mm. The volume of water in Grand Lake, Brian, I know that you have used Google Earth and their topography software to calculate Grand Lake's volume. So how do you describe how much water was in Grand Lake?
So I used Google Earth's topography features in order to basically create a grid back and forth across where the lake bed would be at a particular altitude. Walt lists that where he determined the lake level was at the time of the breach was at about 5,700 feet altitude. And so I simply plugged that in, outlined where that would be in the topography provided by Google Earth. And then I used the topography tool to come up with an estimate and an average depth and determined that the volume was the equivalent to the volume of two Lake Michigans or thereabouts.
Wow. And then there's the volume of water in Hopi Lake. And then as those lakes are catastrophically draining, there's the water coming out of the shore, the groundwater that's catastrophically draining out of the shores of these two lakes, because a few centuries after the global flood, the sediments all over the world, they were just brimming with groundwater. And in fact, there were human civilizations in these high desert regions like the Anastasi in the Four Corners area, Colorado, Utah, Arizona, New Mexico. They built the civilization, their cliff dwellings, and then they just disappear and they don't come back. Well, there was a very high level of groundwater. And for some reason, that whole region, it just dried up. And it seems like it dried up because the groundwater catastrophically drained through the Grand Canyon.
So that is what hydroplate theory proposes was the reason why this area could support a large population of people for a time. But then once conditions changed, then that water was no longer available. And so so the people left that area. The difference here between Lake Michigan and the fact that Grand Lake was two times the volume of Lake Michigan is that Lake Michigan is only at about 570 feet above sea level. For Grand Lake, which is again two times the volume of Lake Michigan, Grand Lake was 5,700 feet above sea level. And so in physics, we learn about forms of energy. And the first two that we learn about is potential energy and kinetic energy. And energy that is about to be released, like lifting a rock up above your head, is termed potential energy. Kinetic energy is what happens when you drop that rock and it starts to move. That potential energy of having lifted the rock now converts into kinetic energy. And so now remember that we had just gotten done saying that something had to exist somewhere up there that had enough energy to carve the Grand Canyon. Well, just imagine lifting two Lake Michigan's worth of water, and not just Grand Lake, but also remember Hopi Lake. It was about the size of Lake Huron in its volume.
Wow.
So really about almost 3,000 cubic miles of water was lifted over a mile up on the Colorado Plateau, and that is a massive amount of potential energy, and that is what Walt was looking for, and that is what he found to explain all the features of Grand Canyon, and it does so very well, as I try to point out in those videos.
Oh, yeah. Your Grand Canyon video is great, and so we'll be getting in the series to then the initial conditions before the canyon was carved, and then how the canyon was carved, and how all the features, the major features, came to be. So, Brian, there's something in Walt's theory called the compression event, and the Bible describes it that the mountains rose up in a day. So during the flood, when the Himalayas, the Rockies, the Andes, these mountains rose up with seashells on their summits, they rose up in a day. And then over the next centuries, not only the mountain ranges, even the entire continents are slowly settling back into the mantle. That's one of the major reasons sea level is rising after the flood and submerging all these coastal settlements around the world. But as the Rocky Mountains, and just like the Himalayans, are settling back into the crust, into the mantle, then the plateau, the Himalayan plateau, rises 3 miles up into the air. It baffles geologists, and the Colorado Plateau rising up a mile into the air. And I just listened to a Grand Canyon documentary today, and they said normally when the continental rock rises up, it folds and becomes mountain ranges, but here it just rose up like a flat table, a plateau, a mile high, a massive flat table. So what is it that raises these plateaus, and why are the plateaus next to mountain ranges?
So as you've pointed out, it's kind of puzzling what the mechanism is. And so what we need to do is search for a mechanism. And that's what Walt has done, is he's been very rigorous about describing the details of his theory of the hydroplate theory via mechanisms. And so you need some very key things in order to raise a plateau. And so what's the lifting mechanism? Well, the compression event is that starting mechanism. And so as the hydroplates, which were continent-sized, rapidly slid on the surface of the Earth, they ran out of water underneath them. And I should point out, they slid on water, and that's part of the, that's why the theory is called hydroplate.
The waters of the great deep, when they burst forth, God created the earth with the firmament, the rakia, the crust of the earth, with the waters below and waters above. And so
that's right.
On one day, all the fountains of the great deep broke forth.
And then about halfway through the flood, the hydroplates, which would become today's continents, they slid on the lubricating waters below that you just described. And so they slid very rapidly, and they built up a great deal of momentum in doing that. When they ran out of water at the end of their slide, they began sliding on solid rock, which at those depths and those pressures melted and melted a great deal of liquid magma underneath the plate between the plate and the mantle. And in doing that, just like a car wreck, the material crumpled, just like the skin on your car when it smashes into a telephone pole. It crumpled up along the western shore, for the Americas anyway, along the western shore. And so you had a great deal of mass piled up, which formed mountains. And the key, though, is that underneath that mass, there was a great deal of liquid magma formed between the underside of the mountains and the mantle. And then over time, over hundreds of years after the flood, those newly formed mountains slowly sank and settled down into that magma and into the mantle. Well, that magma was still liquid, and it had to go somewhere. And so it went the path of least resistance, and it went parallel to the surface and basically created a huge blister underneath the adjacent part of thinner continent.
So as the Rocky Mountains are settling down into the magma, the rock that melted at the compression event, then that magma, it's sort of like a hydraulic system and the pistons, and it's hydraulically then lifting, only hydraulically with magma, liquid rock, it's lifting the Colorado Plateau.
Yeah, the mountains acted like a gigantic piston pushing down on that magma, and the magma couldn't go down itself, so it went sideways. All that magma volume going sideways is what was the lifting mechanism that raised the plateaus, and that is why plateaus are always found next to mountain chains. The Columbia Plateau is found next to the Cascade Mountains, and the Colorado Plateau is found next to the Colorado Rockies, and the Himalayan Plateau is found next to the Himalayas.
And it's not difficult to find mainstream secular geologists baffled, writing that they're baffled about why thousands of square miles would just start rising up in the air of rock.
Hydroplate theory provides the mechanism and the physical explanation of how that all formed. And it does so in a way that no other theory is able to do.
Yeah, it really is beautiful. As the crust in the Atlantic, what today is the Atlantic, eroded away so rapidly, the mantle beneath began to catastrophically push up toward the surface, and the Pacific began to catastrophically subside into the earth. And that's when you mentioned the continents like North and South America literally slid away from the Mid-Atlantic Ridge into toward the Pacific. And then when it all stopped, that's how the Rockies rose up. Also the Appalachians in the east, the Rockies in the west. So then we've described this massive mountain range over the next centuries settling back in. And as it's lifting up the Colorado Plateau, with the magma being pumped under what is today the Colorado Plateau, and it's being block faulted, lifted up, it has on it two lakes, two basins that were filled to the brim with water, massive Great Lakes, Hopi and Grand Lake. And so there's the potential energy to carve out the Grand Canyon after the Kaibab limestone had enough time to solidify, to cement itself, and even the other layers to become partially cemented so the whole canyon didn't just slump in.
That's right. As all that was happening, as that lifting was happening over centuries after the flood, those layers that were being lifted along with the lakes were in a process of hardening and of becoming stone. And we see more than just the Kaibab limestone, but we also see in Arches National Park that certainly there was ununiform hardening happening. And then when Grand Lake breached, those draining waters carved out the soft areas and the hardened areas remained. And that's why we see arches all over in the lakebed region. All these big national monuments with such spectacular views that highlight the iconic Desert Southwest landscape.
Well, when you get a tour of the geology of the Grand Canyon, what's fascinating is that all the amazing sites outside of the canyon, arches, canyonlands, petrified forests, you don't go to the southwest of the canyon. and see these amazing geological features.
No.
This is all mostly in the beds of where Hopi and Grand Lake were,
because when they catastrophically drained, then you had pressurized water beneath their floors, carving up the floor of those lakes to form the stunning landscapes we have, like Monument Valley and so on. It's all so astounding.
And then, of course, some of the amazing features are a result of the sheet erosion that removed the upper Mesozoic layers, like Zion and Bryce National Parks.
You mentioned Arches National Park. We've been keeping track of all the arches that have collapsed around the world, and it really is startling. They're collapsing at such a rate. It's been documented like 100 arches or so in the last 50 years. And guess what? 100 arches haven't formed in the last 50 years. All these geologic features all over the world, they're not millions of years old. They're only thousands of years old. We have photos of two of our sons. One is rappelling down a 100-foot cliff in arches. The other is rappelling off an arch where it's about 80 feet up in the air and there's nothing there. It's so cool to see your kids, you know, doing that stuff. Brian, for those arches to form, you mentioned it, and this is our fourth argument against the flood runoff carving the canyon and this region. You need hardening of some of the sediments. You need uneven hardening and significant hardening of some of the sediments so that some will remain and the rest will be eroded away.
Right. So again, arches in Arches National Park really speak to the fact that those sediment layers in those lake beds, they needed time to at least experience some uneven hardening. And that, again, it takes time. It couldn't have all just happened directly after the flood, or there would have been no arch whatsoever.
All right. So that's four arguments against the flood runoff carved the canyon. Do you have another?
Yes. The fifth item would be the petrification of so much petrified wood that's found in Petrified National Forest, which again is in the lake bed region of what was Hopi Lake.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes time for those post-flood waters that were held in the lake regions, for those waters to cool. And again, hydroplate theory explains why the waters would have been warm, but it takes time for those waters to cool and for them to soak into the tree material, and then for the precipitate of silica to come out of those waters as they cool and to harden the wood fibers into petrified wood. And that all takes, again, it takes time. It takes some time. It's not going to happen instantaneously right after the flood.
All right. So if we could describe this a bit more, I don't know if you visited. We've gone to Petrified National Forest. And so after the flood, you have every basin on the surface of the earth is filled with water, and billions of trees were destroyed in the flood. So you have floating log mats. You have millions of trees, for example, floating in what today would be each of the Great Lakes. And you have trees in Hopi Lake that get waterlogged and they sink. And so becoming a petrified national forest, that takes some doing. So the flood runoff, the waters were not running off the continents for 100 years. They ran off within a period of weeks and months. But to create the petrified wood that's in Petrified National Forest, that's a chemical process. You mentioned the silica. The floodwaters were silica rich, and they had to penetrate these trees, correct? The wood.
That's correct. And it would have taken time for the waters to cool to a point where then the silica would precipitate out into the wood fibers.
So that's another argument that suggests that a lot of time, in fact, a few centuries passed in this region before these lakes were catastrophically drained to carve the Grand Canyon. And so our sixth and last piece of evidence that the floodwaters did not carve the canyon It's actually historical. And when we talk about the global flood, we point to the flood accounts from all over the world where you have native peoples. In fact, the Babylonians had the Epic of Gilgamesh. And wherever you go, to Alaska, to South America, Asia, China, you have the ancient Egyptians, the Greeks, they have a flood account of a flood. The details that parallel Genesis are stunning. These have all been collated. There's a couple hundred of them. Well, in Walt Brown's book, In the Beginning, and on his website at creationscience.com, he provides historical accounts from American Indians that, Brian, it's rather stunning.
That's right. It's not really necessarily a global flood type of a story, but it's a story that they have told about, I believe it's their ancestors, but it's the Navajo people, or as they call themselves, the Diné people, which really just means the people. And they tell of a story of how the canyon came to be, and that they were in danger of being flooded by a large body of water. But then there was a great noise, and so they sent out scouts in all directions to find out what had happened. And some of their scouts came back from the area where the Grand Canyon is now and said, you know, hey, there's this huge mountain that they call it a mountain on its side, or a mountain that's upside down. And basically that was the canyon. And so that pretty amazingly coincides with the events that hydroplate theory puts forth. And so for the Navajo people, or the Diné people, to have this recollection means that they had to have been settled and on the North American continent by the time that this all happened, if this story was witnessed. So if these events were witnessed, then they were witnessed by people, and it took, of course, time for those people to migrate from where Noah was over in Mesopotamian area to get over there. So again, that speaks of there had to have been a great amount of time to have occurred for that migration to have happened, at least a few hundred years.
Wow. So, okay, so I said we had historical evidence, and maybe really a seventh one then. How about biogeography in the distribution of species? I recall reading about rodents, chipmunks, that are on the North Rim and on the South Rim, but there's evidence that they were the same population, but then they have been separated now by this 277-mile long canyon and 10 miles wide. Do you recall that information?
Yeah, I don't remember if it was a chipmunk or a squirrel, but Walt points out in the beginning book that the two squirrels or chipmunks, they basically share a common ancestor, a recent common ancestor, but they are completely separated from each other. One species is on the North Rim and the other species is on the South Rim, and they are separated by a 270-mile trench that they are not going to run around in a lifetime. But that again speaks to that both those species had to have had time to reach the Colorado Plateau area. And again, that speaks that there had to have been hundreds of years before the Grand Canyon was carved, hundreds of years before the flood that happened. It couldn't have happened directly after the flood, or else those two squirrel species would have been the same species.
Hmm. Wow. Brian Nickel, your video, we will embed it in today's show summary. In fact, it's interesting, Brian, you put out your Grand Canyon video and we put out our Big Bang video. So you are now a few hundred views ahead of our video. But what would you think if we have a little friendly competition? What if we make a bet that by the end of the year, we'll see who's got more views, the Big Bang or the Grand Canyon? What do you think?
Sure. That sounds fine.
All right. We have to think about what, maybe a steak dinner somewhere.
Well, yeah, we'll see. You know, depending on who wins, you know, it might have to get downgraded by one of us.
Yeah, that's right. That'll be fun. Also, I'd love to tell the audience that we are taking a Bible tour of Italy in October. What a great time we'll have. It's on our website, rsr.org/Italy, if you'd like the details. We've gone a few times to Israel, Bible tour of Israel. We've done this in Turkey and Greece, and now we're returning to Italy. We say, when in Rome, do Romans. A great time to look at the book of Romans. We're going to have such a fabulous time. So if anybody could join us, that'd be great. And then also, Brian, thank you for giving us permission to publish your Hydroplate Theory Grand Canyon video. So not only could people see it on YouTube, of course, but also they could share it with a friend. There's something about giving someone a nice looking DVD or Blu-ray and just a way to get them to watch it where maybe on their own they might not go over to YouTube and look up a video.
Well, that's right. Well, you're more than welcome, Bob, and I'm glad to do it. YouTube is great right up until the Wi-Fi shuts off and then you wish you had a DVD.
So. Yeah, that's right. So, all right, Brian, I'm really looking forward to part four of our series on the Grand Canyon, to where we talk about the initial conditions right before the Grand Canyon was carved. What did the region look like? And especially, why were those layers so flat, the flat gaps? Why were they as straight and parallel, the paraconformities like they are? What made them that way? That's going to be interesting.
Yeah, well, as we'll see, only hydroplate theory provides a very unique set of mechanisms and physically describes why those features are the way they are.
All right. So looking forward to that, Brian. Thank you so very much.
Well, thank you, Bob. It was great.
And this is Bob Enyart for Fred Williams and Real Science Radio. May God bless you.
Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real. That's what I'm talking about.